Hello and welcome to edition number 2120 of the Whitney Talking News, which we're recording as usual in the High Street Methodist Church in Whitney today, Thursday the 6th of August. My name's Byron Russell and I'm the editor on this edition. Our readers today are Dorothy Allen, Valerie T, Andrew Dilger and Nigel James, and I'm delighted to welcome back a familiar voice today, David Sarbutt. Our technical expert is Rob Oxpring, and he's overseeing all our recordings today. In this edition, we have news and editorial items mainly from the Whitney Gazette, but also the Meteorological Office. In part two of this edition, we'll have a short piece about an amazing climbing feat, and just as the weather is set to get hot again, about alligators. You have been warned. But first, we have part one. Last week, I parked at Woodford Way car park in Whitney, or tried to. It was full, despite various claims that it is little used. We start with Dorothy and the fight to stop the park being redeveloped as housing.
The article is headed, "Proposal Rejected, but Car Park Fight is Far From Over." A councillor has vowed that the fight to stop a car park being turned into housing is far from over after a recent decision. Last week, West Oxfordshire District Council voted against Liam Walker's proposal to carry out a five-week survey using automatic number plate recognition, ANPR, cameras at Woodford Way Car Park in Whitney. While the leader of the Oxfordshire Conservatives said he was disappointed, he also made clear that the campaign is far from over. The proposed development of houses on the car park has been controversial. Critics claim it will impact business in Whitney Town Centre and does not account for large population growth planned in West Oxfordshire. The council said that as it is council-owned land, it means 100% social rented homes can be delivered. A number of options have been considered in relation to the scheme, with current plans to deliver 55 homes and reduced public parking from around 250 to 84 public spaces. The council say that including nearby Marriott's Walk Car Park, there would still be more than 1,660 free parking spaces in the town centre. Critics such as Mr. Walker also criticise claims that Woodford Way is little used, adding that there is not enough evidence to make that claim accurately. He said, "Disappointingly, Liberal Democrat, Labour and Green councillors voted against my motion to collect proper evidence before building on the Woodford Way car park. My proposal was simple. Carry out a five-week ANPR survey to understand how Woodford Way and Whitton Way car parks are actually used before submitting a planning application. Instead, they chose to press ahead without gathering the best available data. Residents deserve decisions based on facts, not assumptions. This vote shows the current administration is more interested in pushing ahead with its agenda than listening to common sense." The council explained that it did not feel the proposed survey would produce accurate data. The spokesperson said, "It was felt the proposed ANPR monitoring would not produce meaningful data due to its timing, as school holidays and improvements work in Whitney High Street would potentially skew the results, coupled with the short-term nature of the monitoring. We are satisfied that the data we have gathered and feel is more representative than what would be achieved within the proposed ANPR framework timeframe. Formal plans for the Woodford Way development will be put forward alongside relevant data later in the year." Mr. Walker confirmed the campaign against the car park will continue, adding, "I remain firmly opposed to building on this much-needed town centre car park and will continue working with residents, businesses and Whitney and District Chamber of Commerce to fight these proposals. This campaign is far from over." And there's a photo of Councillor Liam Walker at the car park looking really rather stern and cross.
And now we have a couple of items about interesting and rather controversial housing developments. First off, Andrew, tell us about what's happening around here.
Thanks, Byron. And the headline is God's County Plea Over 100 Home Plan. Villagers have pleaded to keep the Cotswolds God's County as opposition mounts against plans for 100 new homes. Developers are eyeing up around 18 acres of land east of Litchfield Farm in Lidstone Road, Enston, for the new houses, some of which would be affordable housing. Plans outlined to West Oxfordshire District Council, including affordable housing, school drop-off and pick-up area, public open space, landscaping and associated infrastructure. More than 50 people have written to West Oxfordshire District Council objecting to the plans. Cowell Glendinning, a parish councillor living in Enstone, said, "Enstone is a small rural village with a population of around 1,250 people. An additional 100 homes would increase the population by around 19%, far beyond what can reasonably be described as proportionate growth." Nathan Peart agreed. He says, "Reducing the scheme from 150 to 100 dwellings does not resolve the issue. At around 240 new residents, the proposal is a circa 19% increase in the parish population, well beyond the circa 13% that appeal decisions have found was not limited development." Enstone resident Catherine Home said, "The school is already oversubscribed, which will add to the volume of traffic when the owners of the new houses have to take their children by car to schools in another village or town." Meanwhile, Ronald Bridger is concerned about the reduction of agricultural land and what that would mean for the UK's food supply. He said, "The land is productive agricultural land and should, by definition, be protected against development. This country has a food crisis. We import 30% of our food with concomitant damage to the environment. We need to retain agricultural land to grow crops, which this field has been doing for decades. To cover it in housing would be an act of folly and corporate vandalism." Melissa Day echoed Mr. Bridges' remarks. "We moved to Enstone just under a year ago. What appealed to us was being able to see the lovely countryside, the open fields, and Enstone has a lovely village feel which will be lost if the houses are built. We should be keeping farmland to grow crops, not to build houses where it is not appropriate." James Robinson said, "High numbers of people going to Diddley Squat Farm have already increased traffic significantly over the past few years, particularly at the northern end of Cox's Lane and at the junction of Lidstone Road. This section of Cox's Lane is used extensively by large agricultural vehicles." Family-owned developer Crowdace Homes is behind the project, a firm responsible for Priory Grove in North Oxford and Willowbrook Farm in Willowbrook Park. Discussions held with planning officials revealed they would look unfavourably at 150 homes as initially proposed, Crowdace said. Enstone is classed as a Tier 3 village in the emerging local plan, meaning it is suitable only for small to medium-scale growth. In recent years, Enstone has seen 29 new homes built, all for social rent and shared ownership, on a 4.23-acre site near the village. Built by Orbit Homes, all homes at Enstone Lees are now sold. West Oxfordshire District Council will decide on the planning application in due course.
Thanks very much, Andrew. And now we move on to more controversy, but this time on a slightly smaller scale. Valerie, tell us about the developments that are planned for Shilton.
This is a much smaller development. 16 home plan for village is branded inappropriate. Plans for 16 new houses on the edge of a Cotswold village have been branded inappropriate by furious locals.
developers are planning to build the new homes, of which half would be deemed affordable, in Shilton, between Carterton and Burford. The homes would vary in size, documents submitted to West Oxfordshire District Council show, but neighbours are not happy with the extra houses, saying their village cannot cope with the additional people. Shilton resident Helena Wright said, "Some years ago, as a village, we were turned down for a similar project in the field opposite, so I hope that this will be turned down as well, with the same objections. No street lights, no footpaths, no public transport, and with roads that can get very busy at times." One of her neighbours, John Holloway, said, "The scale of the proposed development is inappropriate for multiple reasons. The infrastructure of the village is already struggling, especially sewage and water." Nigel Rawding said, "Development of existing houses in Shilton is carefully controlled," insisting that granting permission would make a mockery of the policies. Meanwhile, James Dashwood said, "This proposal is unprecedented in scale for the village and should be declined in no uncertain terms. Ridiculous application." Sue Richmond warned 16 extra houses would create a lot more traffic, noting it is bad enough in the school holidays and weekends with the nearby Cotswold Wildlife Park. "We are a small village of 70 houses and there is virtually another town built next to Shilton called Shilton Park, which is attached to Carterton. We don't need any more houses, as villages will soon be a thing of the past, and Shilton has a long history of being a quaint and picturesque village. Let's keep it that way," she said. David Cuthbertson, chairman of Shilton Parish Council, has launched an objection on behalf of the authority. Mike Gilbert, an agent for the developer, said the plans had been designed to meet the affordable housing needs of Shilton. He said, "The proposed development delivers clear public benefits in the form of providing much-needed affordable homes for local people, enabling existing local residents to downsize and so meet another type of local housing need, helping to restore the council's five-year housing land supply, adding vitality to the village by providing a good mix of dwellings suitable for younger people and families, efficiently reusing an already partly developed and partly committed site, and providing 16 highly sustainable new dwellings." The 16 new homes come amid a separate planning application for 18 houses in nearby Shilton Road, Carterton, which is being considered by planning officials. West Oxfordshire District Council will decide on the plans in due course.
Thanks very much, Valerie. And now, a completely different topic. We're moving over to an article about a driver whose actions killed two people and has had their jail sentence extended. Nigel, tell us more.
The heading on this article is "Driver who killed two given longer jail time." A woman whose reckless driving killed two people in a high-speed crash has now been given a longer prison sentence. Liberty Mitchell of Chipping Norton had her sentence increased by 2 years and 7 months after Attorney General Eddie Reeves referred her case to the Court of Appeal under the unduly lenient sentence scheme. The court heard that on December 2nd, 2022, Mitchell was driving towards Aldsworth, Gloucestershire, when she attempted to overtake three vehicles on the wrong side of the road at nearly 100 miles per hour in a 60 mile per hour zone. She collided with one of the cars she had attempted to pass, which was a taxi, causing a pile-up involving multiple vehicles. The driver of the taxi, Octavian Codrianu, was pronounced dead at the scene. His passenger, history teacher Moira Whelan, suffered life-threatening injuries and later died at Southmead Hospital. Mitchell's actions that led to the crash also injured six other people, three of them seriously. The 21-year-old self-employed domestic cleaner was driving the car between jobs at the time of the collision. and her motor insurance policy did not cover use or business purposes. Following an investigation by the police, videos of Mitchell filming herself whilst driving dangerously were discovered on her social media accounts. One video showed her speeding at 100 miles an hour, and another showed her veering to the opposite side of the road onto oncoming traffic. The Attorney General, Ellie Reeves, said Liberty Mitchell's reckless actions behind the wheel claimed the lives of two people and left others with life-changing injuries. My deepest sympathies go to the loved ones of Octavian Coggiano and Moira Whelan, and all those whose lives have been devastated by this tragedy, showing disregard for the danger she posed to others. I welcome the Court of Appeal's decision to increase her sentence, and I pay tribute to the emergency services who treated the injured at the scene. On February the 13th, 2026, at Gloucester Crown Court, Mitchell was sentenced to 6 years and 8 months imprisonment for pleading guilty on two counts of causing death by dangerous driving, two counts of causing death whilst uninsured, and three counts of causing serious injury by dangerous driving. She was also disqualified from driving for 8 years and 4 months, with a requirement to take an extended driving test before regaining her licence. On Tuesday, July the 28th, at the Court of Appeal, Mitchell's sentence was increased to 9 years and 3 months.
The headline is Rising Complaints Against Taxi Drivers in Oxfordshire. A record number of complaints has been made against taxi drivers in Oxfordshire, this newspaper has learned. In Oxford, 549 complaints were lodged to the City Council in 2025-26, representing a 139% rise from the 229 filed in 2021-22, analysis by this newspaper has found. Frustrated passengers and fellow motorists have made 1,965 complaints against city taxi drivers since April 2021. This data does not separate hackney carriages and private hire taxis. Oxford City Council did not provide this data when asked. But Sajad Khan of the City of Oxford Licensed Taxi Cab Association said, "The city's black cabbies remain trusted, regulated and professional for passengers." He said, "Our drivers take great pride in serving the public, complying with all licensing requirements and ensuring that every passenger receives a safe, reliable and accessible journey. Our drivers are highly professional individuals who are all licensed by Oxford City Council and operate under some of the strictest regulations within the passenger transport industry. The hackney carriage trade has always embraced its responsibility to uphold the highest standards of public safety, customer service and accessibility. We work closely with Oxford City Council and fully comply with all rules, regulations and licensing requirements placed upon us. This includes vehicle standards, driver conduct, safeguarding environmental initiatives and passenger safety measures. One of the key strengths of the Hackney carriage fleet is its commitment to accessibility," he added. "We are proud that our vehicles are 100% wheelchair accessible, ensuring that all members of the community can travel with dignity, independence and confidence. We believe the black cab industry is an essential public service and will continue to work positively with Oxford City Council and local stakeholders to support the transport needs of our city for many years to come. In 2025-26, Oxford City Council, South Oxfordshire, Vale of Whitehorse and Charwell received 714 complaints against taxis. This was up from the year before at 601 and with 705 recorded in 2023-24, 594 in 2022-23 and 368 in 2021-22. No data was provided for West Oxfordshire. Charwell Council has said it has suspended or revoked 39 licences in the past 5 years. South and Vale provided the nature of each complaint made against its private hire taxis. Claims of speeding, abusive behaviour and unauthorised parking are a common theme against the private hire taxis. One complaint was upheld by the Vale for a taxi driver who refused to let a guide dog in, while another refused a wheelchair because his boot was full. And here in the picture is a photograph of Sajan Khan with his fist up, and it says he's defending black cabs.
And the headline here is Monstrous Cuts to Disability Cash. Oxfordshire living allowance cuts have been approved despite hundreds of people fearing increased financial pressures, social isolation, and personal safety impacts. A county council plan, previously described as monstrous by former Lord Mayor John Power, will cut disabled people's living allowances and introduce new charges for means-tested travel and an independent living service. This follows a consultation that found a majority of people felt that the proposed changes would result in an overall negative impact, mainly due to increased financial pressures, social isolation, and personal safety. Only 9% of those surveyed by the council thought the plans were reasonable. The cuts, approved unanimously by the County Council's Cabinet on Tuesday, are intended to save £1.8 million a year. The authority currently spends around £302 million a year on its social care system, supporting over 6,800 people. The county's adult care social care chief, Rebecca Fletcher, Lib Dem, said, "I don't want to be doing this, but we do have to face the financial reality in front of us and make decisions that protect the long-term sustainability of adult social care for the people who rely on it." She and other cabinet members described the plan as the first of many cuts to come, adding that people who are unable to financially cope with the cuts can apply for individual assessments. The cabinet meeting had heard the experience of Zoe Williams, a member of the Unlimited Oxfordshire Disability Support Group. She said she had applied for an assessment last year after her social contribution rose from £18 to £70. Zoe described the process, saying it cost her 14 weeks, during which time I was paying more than I can afford, 50 emails, 87 receipts, 49 files, and multiple phone calls, all while battling through chronic headaches and cognitive difficulties. She added that the purpose of disability benefits is to help meet the additional costs. Zoe explained, "Requiring people to justify how they spend those benefits raises serious concerns about dignity and the right to independent living." What are the cuts and additional charges? Proposals involve a reduction in allowances for people with disability-related expenses, such as increased heating costs, additional laundry, specialist clothing, and equipment needs. Social care is not free at the point of service, and the living allowances, known as disability-related expenditure, or DRE, are a percentage of benefits for living costs left to people after paying for social care.
The next heading is Shocking Road and Faded Crossing Spark Complaints. Fears have been raised over the state of a shocking road in Witney town centre, with concerns pedestrians risk injury on a faded zebra crossing. Witney councillor Andrew Coles said he has received numerous complaints about the state of Welsh Way, which runs between Marriott's Walk Shopping Centre and Nuffield Health Centre. The Labour politician said, "I have received numerous complaints about the state of the road on Welsh Way, most especially the junction with Woodford Way by Marriott's Walk and the Witney Fire Station. The condition of the road is shocking. I know because I use it almost every day myself." Among the specific elements identified by complainants are the surface, which has been criticised as uneven, and the zebra crossing, which is faded. Both issues highlighted are between the junction with the High Street and Woodford Way. A concerned member of the public reported several potholes on the road on website Fix My Street. They said, "There are multiple large potholes across the traffic light junction box on Welsh Way turning into Woodford Way. The whole section of the road is breaking up and you can't avoid driving over it as you go through the junction. It has been reported previously months ago, but no action has been taken and the road has deteriorated further." Whitney resident David Willis said that the hot weather has recently erased the white lines on the road's zebra crossing. He said, "I have witnessed many a near miss. I know we have flashing bollards to warn motorists a zebra crossing is there, but when you drive towards it from a distance, it is very difficult to see the white lines. They need resurfacing." Mr. Willis added, "I think it should be an emergency before someone gets seriously injured." Responding to the concerns, a spokesman for Oxfordshire County Council said they are aware of the situation. They said, "The council is aware and the repairs are scheduled. However, Mr. Coles has been unimpressed with the local authorities' lack of urgency so far." He said, "I have been actively pressing Oxfordshire County Council about it for months. The road was finally assessed by highways inspectors back in June and a works order raised. To date, no work has yet been undertaken and I haven't been given an expected start date. I will continue to speak up for those affected by this and push the County Council to prioritise these much-needed repairs. I'm afraid Oxfordshire County Council do need to up their game. Residents have been more than patient."
And now two short items to round off part one of today's edition. First, police issue summer home security advice. Thames Valley Police has issued some home security advice as families head off on holiday this summer. The guidance includes ensuring all windows and doors are closed and locked, using timer switches on lights and radios to give the impression that someone is home, and asking a trusted neighbour to keep an eye on the property. People are also urged to avoid leaving valuables on display, secure sheds and garages, and use outdoor security lighting or a doorbell security camera. Holidaymakers are also advised to be cautious about posting holiday updates and photos on social media while they're still on holiday, as this can alert criminals to an empty house. Secondly, the heading reads, "Fire risk warning as drought declared." A fire warning has been issued now that Oxfordshire has officially entered drought conditions. The Environment Agency declared that seven areas of England are now officially in drought after a long period of hot, dry weather. Those officially in drought include all the counties in the Thames Valley, including Oxfordshire, plus East Anglia, Hertfordshire, the whole of London, Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, and the South East. Devon and Cornwall, the West Midlands and Wessex are also on the list. Helen Wakeham, Director of Water at the Environment Agency and Chairwoman of the National Drought Group, said, "The hot and dry weather means we are currently using water faster than nature can replenish it. A second consecutive summer drought is an exceptionally serious situation and one that will have long-lasting impacts on our environment, wildlife and the economy. We want everyone to stay safe and hydrated during the hot weather, but every drop we can save is a drop more for nature and agriculture." Oxford Fire and Rescue Service has issued a warning about the heightened risk of wildfires in the conditions. A spokesperson said, "The fire risk is still very high and we have seen multiple large fires over the past month, some of which were preventable."
And now it's time for the editor's piece. And given that it's the weather that everyone is talking about, or should I say the lack of weather, here's what the UK's Meteorological Office is saying. After an exceptionally dry July, Questions are understandably being asked about why rainfall has been so limited and whether there is any proper rain on the way. England and Wales have recorded their driest July on record, while southern England has seen its driest month ever recorded in a rainfall series dating back to 1836. These remarkable conditions come after a summer already marked by several heat records, contributing to drought conditions affecting all of Wales and around half of England. Although 2026 has not been dry throughout, the recent lack of rainfall has been very notable. So far this year, January, February, March and June have all seen above average rainfall. But April, May and July have been far drier than average. The issue, therefore, has been less about the whole year without rain and more about timing, persistence and the distribution of recent dry weather. The main reason for the recent dry weather has been the persistence of weather patterns that have kept the wettest conditions away from the areas that need it most. Through much of July, the dominant pattern restricted rainfall to northern parts of the UK, while southern regions saw very little rain, often receiving only a small fraction of their typical monthly average. This meant that even when the UK as a whole saw some unsettled weather at times, rainfall was not evenly spread. Showers and rain bands brought locally heavy rainfall, but left other areas, such as ours here in the south, almost completely dry. If the same broad pattern repeats over several weeks, rainfall deficits can build quickly. Southern and eastern areas are especially vulnerable when this happens because they can often sit on the drier side of weather systems, while the north and west see more frequent rain. The dryness has also been intensified by heat. July was characterised by back-to-back heat waves and exceptionally warm temperatures, which worsened the dry conditions by drying out soils and increasing pressure on water resources. When temperatures are high, evaporation increases and soils lose moisture more quickly. That means that dry conditions can become more severe, even without a complete absence of rain. Gardens, farmlands, rivers and reservoirs can all come under increasing stress, especially when warm conditions follow an already dry spell. That's why recent heat has played such an important role in how dry the summer has felt and in the development of drought conditions across Wales and parts of England. So, of course, the big question is significant rain on the way? And I'm afraid the news is not good. There is some rain in the forecast, but not everywhere will benefit equally. The current outlook indicates that Friday, tomorrow, will be dry for many, before there's rain in northern and western parts over the weekend, and none for us in the south. Dry conditions are expected to continue throughout for much of the south and southeast, where rainfall deficits are already the most noticeable. Friday looks widely dry after a fresh start, with sunny spells and variable amounts of cloud. So, while some rain is on the way, it won't provide a widespread solution to the recent dryness. The north and west are most likely to see some significant rainfall, while much of the south and southeast will continue to miss out on proper rain. Very bad news for gardeners and farmers, not to mention Thames Water. And now it's time for our reflection. And we're delighted to welcome back a name and a voice that will be familiar to all of you, David Sarbutt. David, on behalf of WTN, welcome back.
Thank you. Every year, there are some subjects, like exams, that come around in the calendar. And of course, they are very important in the lives of young people between the ages of 15 to 18. These exams are the milestones in life that have affected so many of us at some point. In my school days, I sat O-levels and then A-levels. A-levels still remain, but the pupils now sit GCSEs instead of O-levels. The exam season finished in June this year, and next week in England, Northern Ireland and Wales, there will be a great deal of media hype, and this can be so demoralising for the students, who, having done their best, find out their results scrutinised in fine detail. This happened in Scotland earlier this week, when the students received their results. Next Thursday, the 13th of August, is the big day for A-level students, when their results are released in the morning. This year's results will enable so many students to begin the next stage of their lives, be it at university, college, apprenticeship, or even beginning to work. So many choices which the students have to make in their teenage years. Some years ago, in a report, the chief inspector of school said he was going to challenge teachers not to concentrate too much on exam results. For he said, "I do not want schools to be more than exam factories, for I believe a rich education is more important than rising league tables." It seems to me that the chief inspector's comments have not shifted the debate, for things have been going on for as long as I can remember. What do we want from our schools? High grades or rounded personalities? Most of us, I would suggest, want both. I was fortunate to go to a school which valued a rich education, and it was committed to an inclusive, calm and safe environment, which celebrated all pupils, students and staff as individuals of worth, created in the image of God. At my school, we had our own playing fields, a dedicated art building. There were choirs and orchestras. Plays were performed. But most of all, there was a rigorous academic programme. I recall from my school days that there were talented students in academia, others on the sports fields, but most pupils were bad at something. And my subject was art. My art teacher said to me once that I liked colour, but he wished I could paint. I did my best, of course, but I now realise that I was doing something during the lessons a bit like meditation, switching off the active brain and just being present in the moment. The writer G.K. Chesterton used to say that if a thing is worth doing, it is worth doing badly. And being bad at art was a good balance to the pressure of exams and the nerves and dread that went with them. I never really managed to conquer my exam nerves, for they were present when I sat my professional exams during my working career. Testing is a part of life. We all need to strive against ourselves to discover who we are. For the A-level students who will get their results next week, and for the O-level students whose results come the following week, exams are like signposts on the way to a greater goal. A version of the Lord's Prayer, which instead of "lead us not into temptation" has "do not put us to the test." What Jesus had in mind is the end of time, the final showdown between good and evil. Whatever is revealed in the next 2 weeks, it is not the final judgment on the lives of the students, only an indicator of where they are going. It is important for them to realise that failure is not the end, and success is only the beginning. Some of us may be having worries in our life at the moment, just like the students are. And our anxieties might be for a variety of different things. But I share with you what the Bible says. To us, cast all your anxieties on the Lord, because he cares for you and for me. And I pray that you will know that for yourselves. Amen.
Thanks, David. Brought back rather tense memories of my own school days, which was rather a long time ago, fortunately. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
And now it's time for part two. And the following deaths were reported in the Whitney Gazette this week. On the 26th of June, Peter Lewis, age not given. On the 1st of July, Thomas Laurie McMath, aged 88. On the 22nd of July, Mavis Rose, aged 89, and Ronald Corney, aged 93. And on the 17th of July, Colin Moss, aged 83, and Margaret Doreen Farmer, aged 88. Our condolences to all their friends and families from all of us here at WTN. Let's move on to the quiz, and now for the answers to last week's questions. Jolly good luck to all our readers in answering these. Number one, appropriately, who was the ancient Greek god of the sun?
Apollo.
Apollo. It was indeed Apollo, yes. Next, which planet is closest to the sun and it's not us?
Mercury?
It is indeed Mercury. Come on, everyone else, you're falling behind here. Next. Which pop group had a hit with the song Sunny Afternoon?
Kinks.
The Kinks. Well done, Nigel. And now, which Ernest Hemingway novel has the word sun in the title?
The Sun Also Rises.
The Sun Also... It's a competition here between Nigel and Andrew. And finally, which British car manufacturer had a model called an Alpine?
Sunbeam.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Somewhere for that there.
Yeah. My father actually had one, so I knew that one. Many years ago. And now for this week's quiz, which is about August. Number one, which two star signs could you be born under in August? And I'll give you a choice. Aries, Leo, Virgo, or Pisces? Number two, under the Romans, what month was August? And again, there's a choice. Was it the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, or the 5th? And now, number three, August is a relatively common name for boys in which country? Choice of four, Sweden, Germany, France, or Spain? Question number four, which famous volcano erupted on the 24th of August 79 AD? Was it Krakatoa, Vesuvius, Etna, or Fiji? And number five, the glorious 12th marks the start of legally shooting which unfortunate game bird in August? Is it snipe, grouse, pigeon, or pheasant? Now we go back to our news, and we're going to start with some news about those alligators before finishing part two of the news section with a remarkable story of recovery.
The heading for this article is Alligators Find New Home in Barbados Nature Park. A group of alligators have been given a fresh start. Seven juvenile American alligators, bred at Crocodiles of the World at Bryce Norton near Whitney, have been relocated to Barbados as part of an international conservation collaboration. The reptiles, offspring of resident alligators Albert and Daisy, are the first of their kind to be introduced to the Caribbean island and will be housed at Paradise Nature Park. Sean Foggett, founder of Crocodiles of the World, said, "American alligators are remarkable animals that play an important ecological role in their native habitats, yet crocodilians remain some of the world's most misunderstood species. Conservation isn't just about breeding endangered animals. It's about helping people understand wildlife, appreciate its role in the natural world, and inspire them to care about protecting it. Every visitor who leaves with a better understanding of these incredible reptiles becomes another voice for conservation. The relocation took more than 2 years of planning and involved veterinary health checks, transportation logistics, and international regulatory approvals. Mr. Foggett personally accompanied the alligators during their journey, overseeing their departure, flight, and arrival in Barbados. Each juvenile measured around 1.5 metres long and weighed approximately 10 kilograms at the time of transfer. Although American alligators are not currently endangered, the project highlights the educational and ecological value of zoological conservation efforts beyond breeding alone. The aim is to raise public awareness about crocodilians, endangered species, and the importance of wetland conservation. Mr. Foggett said, "This partnership with Paradise Nature Park allows us to share knowledge about crocodilian biology, behaviour, and the vital role these animals play in healthy ecosystems. It also demonstrates the value of international collaboration between zoos in delivering excellent animal welfare and meaningful conservation education." Mitchell Hurd, Managing Director of Paradise Nature Park, welcomed the new arrivals. He said, "We have been working closely with Crocodiles of the World for more than 2 years to make this transfer possible. On several occasions, it looked unlikely to happen, so we are pleased to have successfully completed the process. These alligators are the first of their kind in Barbados and will provide visitors, particularly school groups, with a unique opportunity to experience these fascinating animals up close. We hope that by learning more about crocodilians and their importance to ecosystems, people will develop a greater appreciation for wildlife and the need to conserve it for future generations. The alligators have settled in well since their arrival, and there's a very colourful picture of the Sean Foggett and his assistant, and then the two alligator people that are going to look after them over there with parrots on their tops, and it's a really and they're holding a crocodile between them, so rather them than me.
And now a relatively short article for those of you who are fond of cycling and estate agents. The headline is, "Estate agents take on 200-mile cycle for worthy cause." An estate agency is taking on a cycling challenge to raise money for a good cause. Brendan and Lisa Kay, who own Parker's properties in Whitney and Ensham, will join colleagues for the Tour de Parker's, a 2-day ride on September the 10th and 11th to raise funds for Oxford's Ronald McDonald House. The team, including Simon Gregory, Theo Smith, Ash Howes, Morgan Jones, Toby Phillips and Jason Wicks, will cycle to all 17 Parker's branches across Oxfordshire, Berkshire, Hampshire and Gloucestershire. Chloe Hodgson, community fundraiser for Ronald McDonald House in Oxford, said, "The support of our corporate partners, like Parker's, who have built a strong relationship with us over several years is so important, especially at a time when fundraising is so challenging due to the cost of living crisis. The Ronald McDonald House can provide a lifeline for families when their lives have been turned upside down. Last year, we were able to accommodate over 1,000 families. The team aims to raise £10,000 through the challenge, which covers over 200 miles in 2 days. It begins at the Parker's Stroud branch and ends at their new Basingstoke office. This is the second Tour de Parker's ride, following one held 7 years ago." Brendan Kay, Managing Director of Parker's in West Oxfordshire, said, "We are proud to once again be fundraising for the Ronald McDonald House in Oxford. The eight of us are all busy training for the challenge and looking forward to raising as much money as we can."
And now for some good news. Scout Group grateful for £500 donation. A scout group has received a £500 donation from a county council-backed fund. The money has been given as part of the Councillor Priority Fund, which allows each Oxfordshire County Councillor a budget of £10,000 that they can use to support community projects in their area. This money was provided by James Robertson, who said it was to develop the troops' new facility in South Lee near Witney. The Conservative councillor said he was pleased to help. Richard Lord, Chair of Trustees of Witney Buttercross Scout Group, said, "We are very grateful to James for the donation to our hardship fund. This will enable young people from hard-pressed Witney families to join the 350 young people already enjoying the scouting experience and activities in Witney." This is accompanied by a very nice photograph of Councillor James Robertshaw and Richard Lord shaking hands, and Richard Lord looks very smart in his scouter's uniform.
And the next article is headed Dogfest to bring Royal Day Out for canines. A Royal Day Out for dogs is coming to Blenheim Palace. Dogfest at the palace will take over the stately home on October the 3rd and 4th, promising a weekend of canine celebrations in a glorious setting. The event is designed to celebrate dogs and their owners with activities, entertainment, food, shopping and social events. Sam Matthews, Marketing Director at Dogfest, said, "We're so excited to introduce Dogfest at the Palace, set to be one of our most spectacular events yet. Blenheim Palace provides an incredible backdrop for the weekend, dedicated to celebrating the bond between dogs and their owners. We look forward to welcoming visitors and their four-legged friends for a truly memorable experience, filled with fun, adventure and unforgettable moments together. Activities include the Palace Parade, a royal-inspired daily dog showcase, a fun dog show, breed meetups, live acoustic music, and a big dog walk through the palace grounds. Tickets start at £27.50 per person and include entry, parking, and a commemorative photograph, and access to all dog activities. Visitors can upgrade to Dogfest Plus for £35, offering fast-track entry, premium parking, exclusive paddock access and extra treats. All tickets must be booked online and in advance, as there will be no sales at the gate.
The title of this article is Care Home Resident Revisits RAF Roots. A care home resident has enjoyed a heartwarming return to his RAF roots. Phil, a resident at Churchfields Care Home in Cassington, was given the chance to revisit RAF Bryce Norton, where he was able to reconnect with his time in the Royal Air Force. He previously served as a pilot, flying both fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters. The visit was part of the Care Home's Magic Moments programme, which creates personalised experiences to help residents relive meaningful memories and passions. Phil said, "This has brought back many wonderful memories. Thank you to everyone." He was warmly welcomed by the team at the RAF Bryce Norton Heritage Centre, where he enjoyed a private tour of the site. Sharon Rhodes, home manager at Churchfields Care Home, said, "Phil is a wonderful gentleman and it was a privilege for us to make this special day happen." And there's Phil. He couldn't look more happy or elated, standing next to a model of a pilot just ready to get in his aircraft.
And now a hospital story. The headline is Major £11 million investment to transform John Radcliffe. Construction work on a major programme to enhance urgent and emergency care at the John Radcliffe Hospital is underway. Supported by national NHS capital funding, the £11 million Urgent and Emergency Care, UEC, project is designed to help patients access care more quickly, improve their experience, and ensure people receive the most appropriate treatment for their needs. The development will transform currently unused space on Level 1 of the John Radcliffe, part of Oxford University Hospital's NHS Foundations Trust, OUH, into a range of new facilities that will help patients gain speedier access to the care they need while supporting staff to work more closely together and reduce delays in treatment. Improving both patient and staff experience has been a key focus throughout the design of the new facilities. The project is in the delivery phase, with construction work having started earlier this year. Subject to continued progress, the new facilities are expected to open in phases from spring 2027, so next year. A key part of the development is a new 51-bed emergency assessment unit, EAU, for adult patients, with a particular focus on older patients and those with complex needs. The unit will provide short-stay assessment and treatment, helping teams of healthcare professionals provide care more quickly. Working closely with community services, including hospital at home, it is also expected to help reduce patients' length of stay and support more people to receive care closer to home where appropriate. The programme will also create a new Urgent Treatment Centre, UTC, next to the emergency department. The UTC will treat patients with minor illnesses and other conditions that can often be managed outside the emergency department, allowing emergency department teams to focus on those with more serious needs. For children and young people, plans include a dedicated observation area for short-term monitoring outside the paediatric emergency department, as well as new cubicles designed to provide a more appropriate environment for those with mental health concerns. Additional space will be created for same-day emergency care, enabling more adult patients to be assessed, treated, and discharged on the same day without needing to be admitted to hospital. Felicity Taylor-Drew, Chief Operating Officer at OUH, said, "This project represents a significant investment in the future of urgent and emergency care at the John Radcliffe Hospital."
And now, an inspiring story. The heading is "Crash Victim Climbs Mount Snowdon Against the Odds." A motorbike crash victim climbed Mount Snowdon just 16 months after being told he would never walk again. Sam Baldwin from Carterton was paralysed from the waist down following a motorbike accident in March 2025 that left him with multiple spinal injuries. Despite his injuries, the 28-year-old completed the climb in a 9-hour challenge to raise funds for spinal research. Mr. Baldwin said, "I don't remember what happened. I think I swerved to avoid something, but I came off and my bike went on to hit a wall and trees, and so I think I was lucky, even though I did myself a lot of damage." He broke 7 vertebrae in his back and neck, fractured multiple ribs, both shoulders, smashed his elbow and punctured a lung. He spent 7 days in an induced coma and a total of 5 months in treatment across the John Radcliffe Hospital and the Stoke Mandeville Spinal Injuries Unit. Mr. Baldwin said, "My family were told I would never walk again, and I remember spending hours every day staring at my toes, willing them to move. One day I saw the tiniest wiggle, and that tiny movement became a spark of hope." The father of one set himself small goals and gradually worked towards regaining movement. Just 3 weeks after leaving the spinal unit, he fulfilled his wish to walk his fiancée, Izzy, down the aisle, using a walking stick to support him on their wedding day. He said, "Getting up Snowdon was a celebration and a thank you and a way of raising money for a great charity that gives people like me hope for a better future. Coming back down was really tough, one of the hardest things I've ever done. But I dedicate this to everyone who would give anything to take even one step." He was joined on the climb by family, friends, and his physiotherapist, Jack Middleton. Mr. Baldwin said he remains grateful for the progress he has made. He said, "I'm so grateful that I'm still seeing improvements and although I can't carry heavy stuff, run or play sports, I am so lucky to have all the important things that really matter in my life, like being able to take my daughter Aidy to the beach. Suzanne Redding, head of PR for the Spinal Research, praised Mr. Baldwin's achievement. She said, "Many congratulations to Sam for his incredible achievement. What we urgently need is the funds to get these treatments to the people who need them, which is why every pound raised matters so much and why we are so grateful to Sam for supporting Spinal Research." And there's a lovely photo of Sam, very smiling and happy, on the top of Mount Snowdon with all his friends who supported him on the walk.
And now it's time for our notice board, and there are a few events taking place over the weekend, most especially for our listener, Mrs. Pat Thompson of Whitney, who will be celebrating her birthday on the 7th. Many congratulations from us all at WTN. Now, on the same day, at 6:30 in the evening, if you fancy a bit of Shakespeare, Theatre on the Farm's bold outdoor production of Shakespeare's As You Like It blends exciting live music, immersive theatre and the glamour of the Roaring Twenties to create an unforgettable evening. For more details and ticket prices, call 07720 633320. Then, on Saturday the 8th, from 12:30 to 3 p.m, Care UK's Stoford House will open its doors to families and neighbours for a food festival. That's at Farringdon Road, Abingdon. For further information, call 01235 538623. On Sunday the 9th, if history is your thing, you may be interested in a walking tour called Oxford and Empire, which is packed with surprising stories of the legendary, famous and infamous Oxford figures who helped build the British Empire. Meet on the steps of the Clarendon Building in Broad Street, Oxford. For further information, call 07517 797125. Also on Sunday, celebrated pianists Jack Gibbons and Sarah Beth Briggs will offer an evening concert of music, ranging from Schubert to Gershwin. That's at the Holywell Music Room, Holywell Street, Oxford. For more information or tickets, telephone 01865 305305. And finally, in the notices section, a reminder to, yes, test your electric blanket. I know electric blankets are almost certainly the last thing on your mind with this heat, but better to be prepared. The two dates for our area are the 24th of September at Willow Gardens, Chipping Norton, and the 8th of October at the Council Offices, Wood Green, Whitney. It is likely to be busy, so get in to book an appointment early. Call 01865 519800 or book online at service.oxfordshire.gov.uk/blanket testing, all one word. So that's all for this week. If you're not listening online and have a USB memory stick, please remove the stick from the playback unit and close the metal shield. Remember to reverse the plastic address label on the yellow or blue pouch before posting the stick back to us in any postbox. Excuse me. If you wish to get in touch with us, just leave a slip of paper in your pouch and we will telephone you. As well as listening to the USB stick some of you get from us each week, there are several other ways for you to listen to all our editions, including the magazines. Whitney Talking News is available for free online via our website, wtn.org.uk. Please pass on the details to anyone who might like to listen to your own weekly local news programme. And please keep listening at the end of our programme for an infosound item which gives some highlights of this week's best radio listening and audio described TV. Finally, a big thanks to our readers tonight, Dorothy Allen, Valerie T, Andrew Dilger and Nigel James. And of course, to David Sarbutz for his thoughtful reflection. Thanks also to our support team, to Rob, who's recorded this session on our computer, and to Rachel Fielder and Lynn Harding, who have been checking all the pouches and memory sticks you have returned and keeping all our admin records in good order. And before we all go home, the task later falls to Nigel and myself, as we'll be copying the USB sticks and packing them in their little plastic wallets, ready to send out to you all. Now, as you'll undoubtedly remember, we end every programme with a joke, so here's this week's. Did you know that we humans eat far more peanuts than monkeys? Not so surprising, really. When was the last time anyone you know ate a monkey? So, after that, I'm sure everyone would like to say goodbye, and so until our next edition...
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Now for some programmes that are on radio this week that you might find interesting. Inevitably, Saturday the 8th of August is rather dominated on our Radio 3 by the proms, the BBC proms. And in fact, this is all the way through the week. They begin at 5 o'clock on the Saturday, then there's 7.30 and there's a 9.40. There are other programmes that you can listen to, of course, on a Radio 4, for instance. At 9 o'clock in the morning, there's part 3 of a series called What Happened to Counterculture. And this is called Beauty in the Streets, and it opens with the events of May 1968. And looks at how counterculture became more expressly political and increasingly disruptive to the mainstream social order, as Stuart Lee examines the influence of the avant-garde in the politics of 1968 in Paris. There is on BBC Radio 3 a programme that's not about the proms, and that is at 1 o'clock, and it's part of the series Key Changes, Radio 3's Essential History of Classical Music. And this is really based on 1794, the period of the French Revolution, Les Enfants de la Patrie, as it is subtitled. As the French Revolution reached its most violent phase, the pianist Hélène de Mangeroux stood accused and, as legend would have it, saved her life by impressing the authorities with an improvisation of the revolutionary song La Marseillaise. And there are lots of other composers within the programme for the following hour. Switching back to Radio 4, A Fork in the Road, August in Manchester. This is a drama about a chance encounter on a London tube train which reunites Lee with Rick, who met each other at a house party in the summer of 1996. Although she ended up starting a family with Rick's best friend Charlie, sometimes Lee can't help but wonder what life would have been like if she'd chosen Rick instead. The story follows her, as well as Rick and Charlie, in four Augusts, 10 years apart. That's on BBC Radio 4 at 3 p.m. In the evening, Archive on 4, Writing Our Mothers. This is an exploration of how female writers have tackled mother figures in their work throughout history, with contributions from writers such as Susie Orbach, Kit Duvall, and various others. And archive interviews with writers including Sylvia Plath and Maya Angelou. That's at 8 p.m. on BBC Radio 4. That's followed at 9 o'clock by 10 Fights That Made the Green Movement, the first of two parts, repeating 10 episodes, the 10 fights which were used as examples of significant conflicts in the history of environmental protests. That's 9 p.m. on Radio 4. Sunday the 9th of August has more of the BBC proms live and recorded on BBC Radio 3. But over on Radio 4, the Desert Island Discs, this is regularly at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, Neurologist Professor Dame Pamela Shaw talked to Lauren Laverne about her life. Now, Professor Shaw effectively reduced our fear of motor neuron disease, which she terms the worst disease in medicine, and she recalls encountering it as a young doctor in the late 1980s, and then she resolved to dedicate her life to its eradication. She's involved in a treatment that can now slow down its progression. And some of her disc choices remind her of growing up in the 1960s in Kuwait, where a hospital visit predestined her career. And she also talks about the achievements of her team at the Sheffield Institute for Translational Neuroscience, as well as paying tribute to the rugby league player and campaigner Rob Burrow, who died of MND in 2024. So that's Desert Island Discs at 10 a.m. on Radio 4. At 1:30 p.m. on Radio 4 is a programme called Burnham's Pledge. Now here, Kevin Corr explores the Prime Minister's pledge to tackle rough sleeping, revisiting a 2019 interview in which he put rough sleeper Gary's question to Andy Burnham when he was Mayor of Greater Manchester. So that's one of the issues that the new Prime Minister raised right at the start, and there's a discussion of it. 1:30 p.m. on Sunday the 9th of August on Radio 4. Also on Radio 4 is a play in the afternoon, the first of two parts. It's called Libra, and it's Ben Lewis's adaptation of Don DeLillo's fictional reimagining of the assassination of John F. Kennedy from the perspective of a CIA analyst tasked with pulling together all the facts, theories and suppositions surrounding the event. That's 3 o'clock on Sunday, August the 9th, part one of a two-part drama, Libra. Also on Radio 4, this time at 11 p.m, Great Lives, ballerina Lauren Cuthbertson joined Matthew Paris to discuss the life and accomplishments of the dancer Dame Margot Fonteyn. She was born in 1919 and died in 1991. Now, although that's 11 o'clock at night, I raised it because I think most of us know Dame Margot Fonteyn by reputation, if not by experience. So that's 11 p.m. on Radio 4, Sunday 9th of August. Now for some programmes that are on each day of the week, from Monday through till Friday. And on Radio 4, 11:45 a.m, Book of the Week is Hiroshima 8:15, The Lost Memoir. And this is based on Kiyoshi Tanimoto's first-hand account of the aftermath of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, featuring contributions by his daughter, peace activist Koko Kondo. Pastor Kiyoshi wakes up on what feels like a normal day when a powerful explosion rocks the city. He can scarcely believe what he's witnessing, but he's nonetheless determined to help. At 11:45 a.m, Book of the Week, Hiroshima, The Lost Memoir. On Radio 4. On Radio 3, the composer of the week is the pianist of whom I mentioned before, at the time of the French Revolution, Hélène de Montgeroux, throughout the week, at various times. And much later on Radio 4, 10:45 p.m, Book at Bedtime, The Vicar of Wakefield. This is a continuation of the reading that began last week. So episodes 1 to 5 have been finished. This week it's episodes 6 to 10. The Vicar of Wakefield is Book at Bedtime. It's by Oliver Goldsmith. And the whole tale is told through to the end. That's 10:45 p.m. on Monday the 10th of August till Friday. Staying with Monday the 10th of August, the programmes that are on that day alone, 9 o'clock in the morning on Radio 4, Across the Red Line. This is the third part of a programme. Is a university education still worth it? Anne McEvoy chairs a debate on whether university education is still delivering social and career progress for young people, various contributors. That's followed 9:30 on Radio 4 by How Did We Get Here? No World Order. This is part three of Russia Goes Its Own Way. Tristan Redman is joined by journalists Gabriel Gatehouse and Luke Harding to examine the aftermath of the 11th of September attacks on New York and to explore how cooperation between the USA and Russia gave way in the wake of the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. They also discussed the near-fatal poisoning of the Ukrainian opposition candidate Viktor Yushchenko during the 2004 presidential election. So that's How Did We Get Here? Russia Goes Its Own Way, 9:38 morning on Radio 4. In the afternoon at 3 o'clock, Great Lives, a new series. Matthew Paris and guests present a profile of a major cultural figure. In this episode, actor Derek Jacobi and playwright and theatre critic Tim Walker reflect on the work of the actor and director Laurence Olivier, who died in 1989, and of course who was famous for film and theatre and for being such a critical developer of the National Theatre. That's 3 p.m. Great Lives on Radio 4 on Monday the 10th of August. Now to Tuesday the 11th of August, and again more proms on BBC Radio 3, and on Radio 4, starting at 9 a.m, Invisible Hands, The American Century. It's all a lot of politics this week. This is the third part of a six-part series, and it's called Operation Ajax, and it's very topical. Tehran, the capital of Iran, in 1953, hidden in the boot of a car, the American diplomat Kermit Roosevelt III is on his way to meet with the Shah of Iran. Roosevelt is part of a top-secret mission for the CIA ahead of a coup to overthrow Iran's popular Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who is threatening to nationalise the country's oil industry. So that takes us back a long way, 1953 in Iran, and we're still involved with Iran today. There's a play in the afternoon, Tuesday 11th of August. Claire, it's called, at 2:15. Fantasy crime drama by Philip Palmer. A private detective with hypersensitive clairvoyant powers is called upon to find her landlord's niece, who's gone missing in France. That's 2:15 on Radio 4. And at 4 o'clock on Radio 4, Above and Below, the battle to save Britain's prehistoric art. Historian and writer Eleanor Barraclough discovers the challenges of conserving Britain's ancient sites from the impact of global warming, including erosion by unpredictable weather and the devastating effects of wildfires. Her journey takes her from the Uffington White Horse, carved into an Oxfordshire hillside some 3,000 years ago, to Bronze Age rock art in North Yorkshire. That's 4 p.m. on Radio 4. And at 4:30, there's the continuing series of discussions by the two doctors, What's Up Docs, the doctors Chris and Zand van Tulleken, exploring what it means to relax, asking whether the activities people choose actually facilitate relaxation. Staying with Radio 4, of course, at 8:40 is the programme In Touch, the weekly discussion led by Peter White, taking up various topics particularly relevant to blind or partially sighted listeners. That's followed at 9 p.m. by Crossing Continents, part two of a nine-part series. It's about the Victoria Falls on the border of Zambia and Zimbabwe, which is considered one of the natural wonders of the world. Isaac Jacobson reports, however, there's concern that development around the waterfall could threaten the area's delicate ecosystem and exacerbate conflict between humans and wildlife. That's 9 p.m. on Radio 4, Crossing Continents. Now on to Wednesday, the 12th of August, and starting at 9 a.m. on BBC Radio 4, Sideways. At London Euston Railway Station, professional violinist Min Jim Kim is about to get on a train bound for Manchester to perform at a concert. She's taking her 300-year-old Stradivarius, valued at £1.2 million, with her. The violin is her treasured, constant companion until it disappears. In this episode, Matthew Side considers what we value and why. That's 9 a.m. on BBC Radio 4. An hour later, 10 a.m, on a Radio 4 Extra, The Greenham Effect. Politically inept and wrong. That was former Defence Secretary Michael Heseltine's judgment on the women protesting against US nuclear cruise missiles at RAF Greenham Common in 1981. Others would argue the Peace Camp was one of the most transformative social movements of the 20th century, in which the use of theatrical non-violence would shape future campaigns from the likes of Extinction Rebellion. Indeed, the establishment of a female-only space proved empowering, not least because it allowed women marginalised at home and at work to find friendship and relationships. The presenter of Archive on 4, Rebecca Morton, was at the Peace Camp as a child, and she taps a rich oral history of more than 100 women who participated across 19 years. Back to Radio 4, 3:30. Curious title, Methane Eating Bacteria from the Arctic. In 2008, Arctic scientists at the University of Tromsø pulled a sample from a landfill site. The bacteria inside turned out to boast an unusual property. They thrived on methane. For the nearly 20 years since, the researchers who found them have been working on culturing and understanding these bacteria, in part to find out if they could be used to remove methane, a massive contributor to climate change, from the atmosphere and mitigate the warming of the planet. Carl Smith explores their discoveries. That's Methane-Eating Bacteria from the Arctic, at 3:30 p.m. on Radio 4. Still on Radio 4, 6:30, Best Medicine. Louise Broadway, the CEO and founder of Devon Healing Horsemanship, reveals how horses can help people for whom talking therapies haven't worked. Intensive care doctor Matt Morgan argues there's more to breaking bad news than simply delivering it. And comedian Mel Owen shares how short online videos helped lead her to two life-changing diagnoses. That's 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. On Thursday, the 13th of August, on the BBC World Service at 9:30 a.m. and repeated at 8:05 p.m, there's a documentary called The Tree of Diplomacy. Now, we're told that China generally doesn't like cooperating with the West, but this programme about botanists tells another story, one that's been largely untold for more than a century. Orkney-born Mandarin-speaking Finn Aberdeen has produced films about China for more than two decades, and he talks to policy analysts, supply chain diplomats and leading Chinese and US botanists about a long-established but little-known Sino-US political dialogue, so-called botanical diplomacy, which reveals a remarkable soft power between the two nations. Tracing the relationship from field notes taken during the earliest expeditions to present-day collaborators between like-minded plant scientists, Aberdeen learns how the quiet work of botanists has weathered the political storms that have dominated the headlines. The eponymous Dove Tree has much to tell us about human contact. Back to Radio 4. In the afternoon, the play is Security. This is at 2:15, afternoon drama. It's by Kelly Jones, whose recent stage play, My Mother's Funeral, shone light on the darkness experienced by families without the means to pay burial costs for loved ones. In her debut drama for Radio 4, she turns her attention to the black economy fed by habitual shoplifters who sell baby formula and other necessities to parents at a lower price than the supermarkets. It's eye-opening for the polite radio listeners like you and me who may not even be aware of the baby banks distributing essentials all over the UK. This harsh world is softened considerably by the actions of warm-hearted security guard Donna. That's the afternoon play, Security, 2:15 on Radio 4. Staying on 4 at 4 p.m, The Briefing Room. I have to say this is another of my favourite programmes. David Aronovich and guests explore the issues behind a story in the news. But then I guess I'm a news freak. And just for a bit of lightheartedness, at 6:30 on Radio 4, Icklewick FM. This is part 3 of 6 parts, The Festival. In series one of the comedies about a small town radio station. The team are reporting from the town's 233rd agricultural festival. It's at 6:30 on Radio 4. And finally to Friday, August the 14th. Again going to BBC World Service first at 1:30 p.m. and repeated at 10:30 p.m. Heart and Soul. it's a rare opportunity to hear in his own words the story of the great philanthropist Laurent de Cherizet, whose life changed when a car accident left his sister severely disabled. Inspired by gospel stories, de Cherizet founded the Simon de Sirene Association, which since 2009 has built homes around France for people of all faiths and mental and physical abilities. Funding came in part from the box office ticket sales of the hit 2011 film Untouchable, inspired by the story of French businessman Philippe Pozzo di Borgo, who became quadriplegic after a paragliding accident. That's 1:30 and also at 10:30 p.m. on BBC World Service. On Radio 4 at 4 p.m, Last Word. Matthew Bannister reflects on the lives of notable people who have recently died. I've listened to these programmes many times, and it's always fascinating to hear what others think about these people who have recently died. They're usually famous people, of course. Radio 4 has given over the 6:30 slot to a series of different types of humour, and a new series starts on the 14th, Friday the 14th. The People Have Spoken. Ian Smith is joined by other comedians to delve into the latest news stories. Together with the studio audience, they endeavour to solve the biggest problem facing the world. Well, I'm not sure what the biggest problem is, but I can pretty well guess. And finally, at 8 p.m, Any Questions? Alex Forsyth chairs the political forum from Poole Museum in Dorset as an audience canvasses the opinions of four leading figures. Because at this stage, we don't know who the guests are. That's Any Questions, 8 p.m. on Friday. It's also the end of the week. Hope you enjoy some radio listening.
Hello, this is Val from Wharfdale Talking News with my selection of audio-described TV programmes for the period Saturday the 8th to Friday the 14th of August 2026. So starting with Saturday the 8th of August, in Prewleith's Cotswold Kitchen on ITV1 at 12 noon, Sandy Toksvig helps Prue create two dishes from a 1920s pamphlet. In A Cook Abroad, Monica Galletti's France at 12:50 p.m. on BBC One, the MasterChef judge embarks on a culinary tour of the Jura region of eastern France. I don't think the lack of an audio description will detract from enjoying listening to a collection of music that has soundtracked some of the most dazzling sci-fi films of all time. Space Soundtracks at the Proms is on BBC Two at 7:35 p.m. The Bond film Quantum of Solace, starring Daniel Craig as 007, is on ITV1 at 8 p.m. The historian journeys across Turkey, tracing the birth of agriculture, religion, trade, urban life, myths and empire in the new two-part documentary Bettany Hughes' Lost Worlds, Dawn of Civilizations, on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. The second episode of the documentary series Dictator, The Hitler Interviews, on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. traces how he silenced critic to gain total political control of Germany. Newly single, Alan explores fresh experiences to see if trying different things can improve our well-being. How Are You? It's Alan Partridge, is on BBC One at 9:25 p.m. The documentary Elvis, The Colonel and the Mob at 10 p.m. on Channel 4 tells us how the singer and his manager got mixed up in organised crime with the mafia exploiting his shows to aid money laundering operations. Part 2 follows at 11:05. The romantic comedy Bridget Jones' Diary is the late film on BBC One at 10:20 p.m. As the trial draws to a close, Michael's fate hangs in the balance. The drama The Staircase is on ITV One, also at 10:20 p.m. On to Sunday, the 9th of August. On BBC One at 3:15 this afternoon, there is the animated film Wallace and Gromit, A Grand Day Out. Or over on Channel 4 at 4:40pm, there is the musical comedy Sister Act 2, Back in the Habit, starring Whoopi Goldberg. As sea temperatures rise, the challenges of parenthood in the animal kingdom increase. The documentary Force of Nature is on ITV1 at 6pm. Several choices at 8 tonight. The National Youth Orchestra performs in the BBC Proms from the Royal Albert Hall at 8 o'clock. When an environmental campaigner is murdered, several potential suspects are caught on CCTV. But one of them appears to be a famous singer who vanished and was presumed dead. Find out more in this week's episode of Van der Valk on ITV1 at 8. The actor arrives on Sicily, home of Cyclops, in the second part of Richard E. Grant's Very Modern Odyssey, on Channel 4 at 8. A new drawing from Bethany leads Gabs and Dick to the old ruins, where the truth is revealed. The final episode of The Rapture is on BBC One at 9pm. The search for remarkable amateur pianists continues in Manchester. The piano is on Channel 4 at 9pm. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. And this week there is live coverage of the European Athletics Championships on BBC One, Monday to Friday, each morning from 10:30 to 1:15pm and in the evening from 8 to 10pm. So subsequent programmes may run late or change. And although not audio described, the commentary should give you an idea of the action. Escape to the Country is at 2:45pm and The Repair Shop is at 3:30pm each day on BBC One. Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15am and Bargain Hunt at 12:15pm have moved to BBC Two this week. On ITV One, Dickinson's Real Deal, that's at 2pm each day. On Channel 4, there are four episodes of the sitcom Frasier starting at 9:10 each morning, Monday to Friday. On ITV3, there are two episodes of Heartbeat starting at 5:50 and 6:55pm, Monday to Friday. Now for Monday, the 10th of August. Father and son, Martin and Roman Kemp, set off on a journey in search of the legends, landscapes, mystery and history that have shaped the people and culture of Ireland, beginning on the south coast in County Cork. Martin and Roman's Irish road trip is on Channel 4 at 8pm. Two more teams compete in University Challenge at 8:30pm on BBC Two. Chris Packham ends his story of evolution with a look at how the horse emerged as one of the planet's greatest athletes over 500 million years. Evolution is on BBC Two at 9pm. Christine was discovered in a Waterloo train carriage as a baby and wants to know who left her there. Find out more in Long Lost Family, Born Without Trace on ITV One at 9pm. Bob and Paul visit the Highlands in tonight's repeat of Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing on BBC Two at 10pm. Tuesday, 11th of August. The remaining sewers tackle the world of sportswear in this week's episode of The Great British Sewing Bee on BBC Two at 8pm. DCI Stanhope investigates when two people are murdered at a country house. Vera is on ITV3 at 8pm. The historian sets out to discover whether England's first ruling female monarch was as bloody as her reputation suggests. Bloody Mary, Lucy Worsley investigates, is on BBC Two at 9pm. Dr. Angela Gallup reveals how clues found in blood traces helped to solve two cases, including the killing of 10-year-old Damilola Taylor. Cold Case Forensics in the Blood is on ITV1 at 9 p.m. Oti and Richard's journey concludes in the Eastern Cape, where they encounter a herd of elephants. Oti and Richard's South African Odyssey is on Moor 4 at 9 p.m. Wednesday, 12th of August. A water-damaged photo of President John F. Kennedy's children with their English nanny and a broken stringed instrument from Venezuela are among the items brought into the repair shop on BBC Two at 8 p.m. The discovery of a Second World War bomb shelter in their back garden adds a surprise element for a couple renovating a Canterbury B&B. Extraordinary Extensions is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. The owner of a fruit and vegetable company is found stabbed in his own home. The Chelsea Detective is on the U and Drama Channel at 8 p.m. The concluding part follows at 9 p.m. The body of a man who had been shot dead while walking his dog was discovered in rural Perth and Kinross. This programme follows events in Scotland's High Court as his former colleague stands trial for his murder, but there were no witnesses and no forensic evidence. The first episode of the two-part documentary Murder Trial, Death of a Dog Walker, starts on BBC Two at 9 p.m. Spy Next Door, the Anna Chapman story, on Channel 4 at 9 p.m, tells the story of the Russian businesswoman and model who was unmasked by the FBI in 2010 as part of a Russian spy ring. Continues tomorrow at the same time. Shane and Clifford hatch a plan to abduct the wife of a hedge fund manager. It seems foolproof, but is it? Find out in Inside Number 9 on BBC Two at 10 p.m. On to Thursday the 13th of August. In Emilia-Romagna, Tom joins a local producer at the chestnut harvest and learns of their importance to the region. Tom Courage Cooks Italy is on ITV1 at 7:30 p.m. In a new competition, seven pairs of aspiring art dealers try to turn a profit in a highly competitive industry. The Big Deal with Steph McGovern is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. David Olusoga tells the story of an Edinburgh house through the people who lived there, in a new series of A House Through Time on BBC Two at 9 p.m. The teams land in Zurich, where they take on the Governess and the Dark Destroyer. The Chase Around the World is on ITV1 at 9 p.m. In 2020, Rhiannon Rudd became the youngest girl to be charged with terror offences in the UK. This documentary re-examines the events that led her into the criminal justice system. The Schoolgirl Terrorist is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. And so we come to Friday, the 14th of August. The Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra perform in tonight's visit to the BBC Proms from the Royal Albert Hall at 7 p.m. James tackles hair loss head-on, hoping to fix his hairline and his confidence in an 8-hour transplant involving over 2,000 grafts for £9,000. Find out if it worked in Surgery Secrets of the Super Rich on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. The sleuth discovers a murderer is using a model village to plan their attacks. Father Brown is on the U and Drama Channel at 8 p.m. The team makes a breakthrough in the search for Kate's missing phone, but then Bergerac's world is turned upside down. Bergerac is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. We end this week's selection with the sitcom Android on BBC One at 10:40 p.m. Sue and Linda are going on a camping trip, with Sue eager to catch a rare meteor shower. So I think we're going to be ending with Fun and Games this week.
Do
TNF Soundings.